This is episode 3 of the Rhode Island Liberty Report. In this episode, we talk cannabis legalization, growth of the Rhode Island government workforce, eminent domain, Rhode Island Commerce Corporation, and the RICAS test scores. So let's get on with the show.
Welcome to the Rhode Island Liberty Report, your source for libertarian commentary on current events in the Ocean State and Southern New England. Coming to you from Rothbard Studios, here are your hosts, Mike and Eric.
Welcome to the Rhode Island Liberty Report from LibertyRI.com. I'm Mike, and in the studio here with me is Eric.
How's everybody doing?
Good. So we took a little break last week, Thanksgiving. Hope everyone had an enjoyable holiday. Took a little break from politics and just kind of chill out, spend some time with the family. But
you don't talk politics, Mike, at your Thanksgiving table?
Although we did a little bit, actually, oddly enough, but... it was friendly politics.
So that's always
good.
Yeah.
It wasn't a bad thing, but we're back at it, and we're a little bit late this week. Some sickness going around and petulance, and speaking of petulance, is that how you pronounce it?
I think it is petulance. Yes, petulance.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Rhode Island.
plenty of that to go around.
Yeah, lots happened in the past couple of weeks, and. I guess not just Rhode Island, but Massachusetts. A big thing happened up in Massachusetts, and that was a big topic of discussion. Well, it's kind of faded out a little bit, but we might as well cover it because it's very libertarian.
Right. So the Mass, obviously, anyone who follows the legalization of marijuana efforts across the country, Massachusetts, finally, the date came around where stores were opening and open for business, selling pot products to anyone who wanted to buy them at a premium price from what I've seen too with the taxes and stuff that are they're levied on the pot brownies and gummy bears and all sorts of crazy stuff they're selling there. So the response is it's been huge. It's something like $2.2 million in sales the first weekend.
That's what I read.
Across the state. And interestingly enough, a lot of these places are opening up right across, in these border towns, like Seekonk or, I'm not sure what other towns are, sort of up near the New Hampshire border, but, they're clearly trying to attract people from other states. And obviously it's illegal. I'm pretty sure you can't go buy stuff and then bring it back across state lines.
Technically, no.
I mean, yeah. I'm sure nobody's doing that.
No. But, just like nobody brings fireworks back from New Hampshire or wherever.
But again, it's like, here's another instance where it's like, as bad as Massachusetts is in a lot of ways, I mean, they're ahead of us on so many things. And they're always first. It's always like, oh, let's see what Massachusetts does. And then maybe we'll follow suit. Let's take this wait and see approach. Look, this is an idea whose time has come. And obviously for us, I think as libertarians, it's not even so much about the practicalities of it. It's just a matter of, look, engaging in commerce, unless you're aggressing against somebody else, shouldn't be illegal. No. It doesn't matter what you're selling, right? And consuming a product and putting it into your body shouldn't be a crime.
No.
It doesn't matter what it is.
And here's another aspect that people that are in opposition to the use of drugs throw back at us. And it's well, you think everybody should be getting stoned. We're not, saying that somebody should be able to do something is not the same as saying somebody should,
right?
And people can't grasp that. So, their version of morality, they use government force to impose their version of morality on other people.
Right.
And again,
they look at legalization like, okay, if it's legal, it means it's okay or it's good.
Right.
And if it's illegal, right, it's bad.
Yeah.
And that's the only way they see it.
And, there's a lot of people out there that advocate, for the use of marijuana today, and it's good, and I'm indifferent about it. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying it's a choice a person makes, and they should be able to choose how they, what they do with their body and what they put into their body. It's that argument of can't think outside of the parameters, right? Again, it's saying someone can or should be able to is not saying that they should. And
that's a nonsense argument that people use. I mean, it really is. It's like, there's a lot of things that are legal to buy in the store that are deadly.
Right.
I mean, you can go to the store and get bleach. If you wanted to, you want to drink bleach, you'd die pretty darn quick. You're not going to die by smoking a joint.
No.
Right. Just from smoking it. You're not. And so, so that's the point. It's like, obviously, there's special interests here who have an interest in keeping this stuff illegal. Right. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies right off the bat. Right. And if you look at it, the process by which this stuff is becoming legal, right? Where did it go first, right? It went through the medical route first, right?
Right.
And it's gotten to the point where there's a lot of these pharmaceutical companies are now, you know, are producing products,
mm-hmm.
With, you know, I don't know,
CBD.
Yeah, cannabinoid. I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Right.
But my point is like they want to make sure they're getting theirs first, and look. You know, I think it was Bill Maher, who I definitely don't always agree with, but he said something like, if you put marijuana up against Prozac, you know, marijuana is going to win every time.
For sure. Yeah.
So, but the other issue I think that's interesting here is, you know, I think this goes to our sensibilities is that we get very excited. Like, oh, this is great. You know, they're legalizing marijuana. This, you know, we're not going to be putting people in prison for this victimless crime. But of course, in order to do that, it has to come with this heavy tax burden.
Right.
And regulation.
To feed the beast.
And it's like, we have to make this devil's bargain in order to get this done. And it's like, no, like, I don't want to settle for that.
No. Yeah. It's that, again, going back, okay, we're going to give you this, but we're going to use it to our advantage so we can continue to fund the bureaucracy and government and expand and all this other stuff, which brings a good point. This is something I've been wanting to do for a long time since last year on Liberty RI, as far as an article goes, is breaking down the proposed legislation that's been put before the General Assembly year after year. And if you actually dive into it, that people that advocate for this legislation, 9 times out of 10 have never read it. And if you do read it, it's actually not a good thing. It just increases government overreach on us. And for example, Rhode Island's decriminalized, right? So we already, you know, possession under an ounce is just a civil fine. It's like a parking ticket. No criminal, nothing on your criminal record. Now possession over an ounce is a criminal offense. And it's been a while since I read it. So I forget if it's a felony or misdemeanor, but when you look at the legislation for legalization, the under an ounce has just, they've taken away the civil fine, but over an ounce possession in public or outside of your home, I believe, is still a criminal, offense.
Right. So legalization is sort of a misnomer.
It is.
It's not legalization. It's not even legalization.
It isn't. Now, what also comes, the additional baggage that comes with that is if you want to grow it yourself, you can get your plants licensed. Now, with licensing of these plants, now you open yourself up to inspection, right? So now you're opening your home up to,
wow, for, right, that's to a good inspection. Point.
And then you, right. There's all these parameters that come with it. You have to, you know, requirements. You can't grow it outside. You can't grow it within public view. You can't, all these additional measures that come into place. It's almost as if I'd rather just keep it where we are now with decriminalization and not have to worry about all that other stuff. Because what happens if, you know, I think the limit is 2 plants per person, if I recall right. I could be off on that.
I think that's right.
Yeah. But what happens if you have, like, every year in spring, we have tomato plants pop up in our garden that, like, we did not plant. You know, like, what if you have some kind of spontaneous growth that you didn't realize, and all of a sudden that's not licensed, and someone, it also calls for the creation of this bureaucracy to enforce these regulations. So what if the pot inspector comes to your house, you know, to say, oh, I want to check to make sure your licenses are valid. Oh crap, there's a spontaneous growth in my plant, you know, like,
you have the right to remain silent, Mike.
and those, if I recall, are felonies. So like, it's not even, again, we're going to break it down at some point and in a good article. I want to wait till the new legislation comes out just to see if there's any variations.
I think that, yeah, it makes sense.
But it will come up, and most years it's the same thing. They just copy and paste it. It's the same legislation, but it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
I mean, when it comes right down to it, is the government is, in the state, it's no different than the mafia.
No.
They're just a mafia with with, you know, legal backing. That's all they are. They want their cut. They want their cut of everything. And what do? They provide protection.
Yeah.
Right. That's their whole bargain with you. Basically what they say, we'll keep you safe. Give us a cut.
Right.
Okay. I'm sorry. You guys are a bunch of immoral hacks. That's all you are. And you're taking money out of people's pockets at gunpoint, who, you know, want to smoke an herb they can grow in their backyard.
Right.
Like, give me a break. Just give me a break.
So I think it's safe to say from a Liberty RI perspective, we are, and this was just some confusion on a post a couple weeks back on our Facebook page. We are for the complete decriminalization, deregulation, descheduling of, we'll just stay with marijuana for now. We won't talk about other drugs.
Right.
We'll save that for another time. But,
right,
you know, there should be no government. It should be regulated like the tomato plant that I grow in my garden.
Absolutely.
You know, that's
right. Absolutely. And I know that there are some, cannabis advocates in the state who balk at this legislation, and people are confused by that. And, you know, like, well, I don't understand, why wouldn't they want this legalized? And you have to understand that, you know, they've got the right perspective on this, in the sense that this is not legalization that's being put forward, or that has been put forward in the recent past in the legislature. And look, we shouldn't have to settle. And I think that, you know, especially in terms of, one of our biggest arguments is that when you legalize something, when you really truly legalize it,
right,
you eliminate the black market. And the way that this is, and I'm telling you right now, even the way it's set up in Massachusetts, they're not going to eliminate the black market, because this stuff is way more expensive. It's a good, like, what, 30% to 40% more expensive than you can get it on the street. And no one's having any problems getting this stuff on the street.
And to your point there, what happened when these, I believe it was just two stores, right, that opened up so far, they were delayed because of trying to get compliant with the regulations. So I believe it was July. Don't quote me on that. But it's been months in delay until they finally opened up. And again, they're trying to jump through hoops to get opened up. And then there's only two stores that have met the requirements so far. So now you've got this huge demand, right? And people are complaining in the towns because there's too much traffic.
I saw that.
Like, well, that's a byproduct of stores not being able to open to compete, to provide, you know, to spread the impact out to multiple locations. And that's the issue there, right?
Right.
So they're using that excuse to try to shut this down, as opposed say, no, this just needs to be opened up more.
When the government tries to regulate not just business, but property rights, right? When they try to regulate property, where a business can open, when it can open, why it can open, what the zoning is of a certain particular area, all they're doing is creating these ancillary problems, okay? It's like if you have an ailment, right? Let's say you're sick, you've got sore joints, and, you know, you've got really high cholesterol or something, and you're not doing well. The government is the pill pusher, right? They're the one who's saying, here, take this pill for that, take this pill for your high cholesterol. And then before you know it, you're taking 10 other pills, because now the side effects of the original pills have caused 10 other problems.
Yeah.
When you could just eat better, right? You could just exercise more. You could address the root problem of the root causes of these ailments, and you'd be healthy.
Right. And I think people, as this podcast goes on, are going to see that's the approach that we take.
Absolutely.
On almost every subject. You know, people complain about the symptoms instead of going for the disease, right? It's, we want to treat the symptoms.
Yes.
And we're not going to, you know, cure the disease.
Yeah, we got to stop missing the forest for the trees here, and with all of these issues. And I think as libertarians, with not just with the podcast, but with, you know, there's a lot of other libertarians. It's not just us. There's a lot of libertarians out there in the state who are very vocal. And I think that this is something that we've really brought to bear recently, over the last year or two. All of us is an ability to crystallize certain issues down to the real fundamental problem. And I think with every issue that we discuss, I think we all really try to do that, and make things really clear. Look, this is why this is happening.
Right. I think now, of course, Rhode Island, circling back, you know, bringing it back around to Rhode Island, we've dropped the ball, right? We missed the train, and Mass beat us to the punch. I see there's a potential for Rhode Island to make some headway here. And not tax it, right? If Rhode Island decides not to tax it, guess where everybody's going to go to buy it?
Here.
Right. And the price, the market will adjust, right? So if it's being taxed in Massachusetts at, you know, whatever percentage rate it is, that's driving up the cost in Mass. So all the businesses in Rhode Island would have to do is undercut that by a certain percentage and make that all in profit. And where's that money going to go? It's going to be spent locally and within the right. economy. The money's going to go back into the economy instead right. of going into the government coffers, which, you know, the government, we'll talk about this later on, but, you know, they think they know what's best, how to spend the money in the economy, and, you know, that they want to take that money. So,
yeah, it's just one final point I want to make on what you just said, which is so fascinating in terms of people's psychology on these sorts of issues, which is, you know, they look at, okay, well, the government, this is our democracy, right? It's the democratic way of deciding how this money gets spent. And this is the best way to figure out what the best ways to use our resources are. I'm sorry, there's nothing more democratic than the free market and consumers who every day, multiple times a day, millions and millions of times a year are voting for certain things with their pocketbooks, as opposed to voting every 2 years on one day.
Right.
You've got to be kidding me. Right. I mean, if you want to talk about real democracy in action, the marketplace has got it in spades, man.
Yeah.
In spades.
The marketplace sending, like you said, thousands and millions of signals to entrepreneurs and business people is a hell of a lot more, you know, accurate than the, you know, a handful of politicians trying to figure things out figure out what they think the best idea is.
They may call it a democracy. It's an oligarchy. Yeah. It's a bunch of right. political elites who are making decisions, and they're saying that they're representing the people. But what are they really representing? We talked about this in a previous podcast. I mean, the voter turnout is a joke. They're not, what are they representing? They're representing themselves. They're representing the interest. They're representing the people who are giving them money. We all know this. Right. Just like businesses represent their customers and people who give them money.
Right.
Only businesses represent a lot more people. So a lot more people are giving them money than politicians are. Yeah. So
it's,
and speaking of the state apparatus.
Yeah, exactly. And continue to grow. I'm always sure we'll circle back around to this issue many more times in the coming months and weeks. But there is a
business
of government.
There's a business that's growing in Rhode Island.
Right.
And it's government.
And they want more money to grow it even more.
But, right.
You know, and that's government. So there was a report that came out that you'd found in the Providence Journal.
Right. So basically what it said was that I think it was the state workforce itself has ballooned up to over 14,000 jobs, which is the most since 2009, which is when I believe it was after the crash happened and Kachiri was forced to, you know, drastically slash the state workforce. So it is at the highest level since then. Basically. But I think, and so look, again, the more state government grows, the more employees the state government has, those are resources that are being taken away from the economy. We should not be shocked that as this sector of our economy grows, that it detracts from other places and it's going to hurt our actual economy. The real economy, okay? I think the other part of this that's interesting that I really wanted to mention was that sort of isn't reflected in the numbers in this article is that just a quick Google search of Rhode Island employment data, if you take into account all the local government workers, so that would be like, you know, public works departments, teachers, I believe also would be included in that, you know, administration, and also federal workers who work in the state.
Okay.
The total number of government workers is about just over 60,000. Okay. And just to give you an idea of what that means, how that relates to the rest of our economy. Okay. That's 12% of our entire workforce. 12% of our entire workforce in the state works for the government, whether it's state, local, or federal. Okay. That's three times as many people as work in construction. That's insane. That's 50% more than people who work in manufacturing. And 20% more than people who work in retail.
Unbelievable.
I mean, and they provide a crappy product at super high costs, right? Because they're a monopoly.
Right.
And what do we do in this state? We want more, bigger government, more money going to the government. We keep voting these people in. I mean, again, some of us are voting them in.
Yeah.
Some of us aren't. Right. It's just
us people with the state jobs who keep voting.
I mean, well, that's and that's
the demographic right
that's
there.
The moral hazard.
Yeah.
I mean, the more, you know, I mean, and look, these stories just keep coming out. We talked about the sheriffs, you know, last episode.
And to follow up on that, we posted on the Facebook page. Yeah.
WPRI is trying to get the names of the sheriffs to find out who these people are. And we talked about this last episode. It's like, you know, are there privacy concerns here? You know, what's right? You know what? No, we deserve to know who these people are.
Yeah, I don't care what their injury is. I just want to know, why are they stealing my money?
Right. Or you know, I want to know. Yeah. I
mean, like, who they are. Who's stealing my money?
They're my employees. They work for me. They don't work for the state police.
Yeah.
Right. The state police work for me. They work for you. They work for, if you're listening out there, they work for you. They're your employees. And all these state workers are your employees. Now, technically, if these state workers live in the state, they also work for themselves.
Right.
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 So, but look, I don't care where you work. You are accountable to your employer. So if you take a state job and all of the benefits that go along with it, this is part of the deal. I'm sorry. It's part of the deal. And, you know, I think we should be really concerned about how much the size of state government is growing, not just in terms of the amount of dollars they're taking in, but the amount of employees that they are hiring, and also, you know, the size of the bureaucracy.
And then you've got the pension obligations on those employees that are just
exponential.
Our taxes on our children and our grandchildren and their, you know.
Exponential.
Interesting little side note story here. I was on my way to work the other day, and it was a bit of a traffic jam. And I'm like, what the heck is going on? Is it an accident or whatever? So I got up closer to it and then got to the stoplight, and I looked across the intersection, and there was a Rydot road crew patching a pothole. There were four guys standing in a circle. One guy was tamping down the asphalt. And three guys standing around watching him do it. One guy was holding a broom while he was watching, so I suppose he'll start sweeping up at the end. But again, four employees, two vehicles, one of them a construction vehicle, and then a dump truck and I think it was a pickup truck. But I mean, it's
almost like three supervisors for every laborer.
Yeah.
And what time of day was this, by the way?
It was in the morning.
During rush hour?
8:45. Yeah.
All right. So. Yeah. I mean, it would be way more efficient to do this crap at night when no one's driving around. Right. But exactly. if you have a monopoly on road maintenance, why you're going to do it when you want?
Yeah,
these workers don't want to work in the middle of the night, so they'll do it whenever they damn well please, and they don't care about whether or not it affects your commute. They don't care. I knew a guy I was really good friends with who works for DOT. And he was a supervisor. He was actually pretty, he was the supervisor of an entire garage, right? So he was actually, pretty high up in terms of dealing with the workers. And this guy, and he did not fit the stereotype of the state worker, okay? This guy worked his ass off. He demanded a lot of his workers. And guess what? No one wanted to work for him. He couldn't get anything done. All he did was complain about how it would take 6 months to get one part that he needed to, say, fix a truck to get out there. And projects would be held up for months and months and months because of all the paperwork and hoops and red tape that just to get a simple little part to do something because of the size of the bureaucracy. Yeah. And every time you add a job to the state government, it adds 10 more layers of red tape.
Right.
And they don't care about efficiency. They have no incentive to care about efficiency. For one, because they keep getting voted in. That's one reason. Yeah. But there's no financial incentive.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I think we should also, like you were talking about your friend, he's a good guy. Like, there are good people who work in government. That's the job they got. Again,
there are great people who work
in government. They don't think like we think. So, they don't understand the aspects of it. I understand that aspect of it. I mean, I have family members and that work in government, and they're good people. I've had interactions with the government that have been good. Secretary of State's office. I've been there a couple times to get like voter lists and things like that. Great people there. The people themselves are friendly and courteous and helpful, and they do a good job.
Right.
But again, it's the idea that we don't agree with.
It's the idea that we don't like. And it's also the fact that there are good and bad people in every walk of life, every profession. Yeah. The difference is that the bad people in the free market get punished by going out of business.
That's right.
The bad people in government get rewarded, yes, if anything.
We used to have a joke in the Army where we deal with, we call them DA civilians, Department of the Army civilians, people working for the federal government, that, you know, when someone's horrible, they, again, union things, right? They just promote them. Like, they just move them up.
Yeah, I don't want to deal with this guy anymore. No, let's make him a general.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, they're civilians, so they're not, you know, they're not getting that aspect, but it's just, you see,
let's make them president.
And it's, I'll save the story for another time, but I mean, I had some dealings that were just,
I can only imagine. I would love to hear that. It reminds me too of, did you ever see the movie, The Pentagon Wars?
No. I know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about?
I've not watched it, but yeah.
Well, the whole idea was that basically, just real quickly, just not to get too deep in the weeds here, but it's a really cool movie, actually, with Kelsey Grammer and Carrie Elwes, you know, from Princess Bride. Yeah. But the whole idea was basically that, they're building this tank, and the tank was originally supposed to be one thing. It was supposed to be this quick, fast, like, scout vehicle, yeah, and it turned into this massive, like, force of nature, right, that had no armor on it, that, you know, the armor was hit by a shell and it produced this toxic gas and killed all this, you know, would kill all the soldiers inside of it. And basically the people who actually tried to stop this project from going this route were basically reassigned, and the people who got this thing done got promoted,
right?
And yeah, and you know, because they got something done and they, you know, put together this product or whatever. So it was just it's a great example of government malfeasance being rewarded,
right,
in all the worst possible ways. It's a good movie. I definitely recommend it. But, you know, these are the kind of things that happen when, you know, and our state keeps getting bigger and bigger. And look, I mean, we look at the economy and it's a bubble. It's not going to last forever. We're looking towards down the road to another recession. You know, this is one of the signs when government grows and grows and grows, it's a sign that economic troubles are ahead.
And this is one of the items to talk about, but just been keeping an eye on the news and articles. There's some articles, predictions about Rhode Island's economy is usually the first to start to decline. And there's some indications that that's happening. Just this past week or two, I've heard a bunch of restaurants closing. Remington House,
right?
Some institutions within the state, right? Yep. What's it? Country Inn, in Warren, was it Country Inn?
I don't know the name of it.
Yeah. I think
I know. I heard about the Remington House in closing up shop, and did they say why? I don't know if they.
I haven't read why.
I don't think they said why, but it is interesting that these places are shutting down, and and I think that the other thing you look at too is it's not just a matter of the government taking more resources and growing itself, mm-hmm, but it also seems like it's trying to depress growth,
right,
in the private sector at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's trying to control property. And, you know, this sort of this other story that came out recently about Apex.
Right.
Apex property the council's trying to get declared blighted so they can take it over.
Exactly. So it's interesting because that's usually the criteria for eminent domain, right? To take over a property. If it's blighted, they can, you know, there's a couple reasons they can do this, right? One is they need to build a highway or railroad or something like this. The other one is if it's a blighted area, they can take it over to revitalize. Interesting, the whole PawSox debacle, one of the outcomes from that legislation that was passed for the PawSox is they're now, they have the additional ability to take it over if they want to build a state, for example, a stadium. So now that's obviously gone away, but now they've refocused back on the same property that they wanted to use to take over.
And it's almost like they don't really care, what goes there. They just want to get rid of this thing.
Yes.
And they're aggravated that the guy who owns the property isn't doing anything with it for whatever reason. And they don't like it.
No,
they, you know, and they want to pull the levers of power. And they want to tell this guy what to do with his property. The other thing that came up recently too, that was very similar to this, the story is it was in North Providence, with Charlie Lombardi, the mayor, basically taking a guy to court to knock his building down.
Right.
Cause you know, and I mean, I'll tell you what, this guy is my hero. Not the mayor, this guy, Dr. Farina, this guy owned this building. Right. So basically this guy, He owned these two very prominent buildings on Middle Spring Avenue. He renovated one of them to this beautiful medical building. And the other one just has been sitting there. And it's, you know, it's very dilapidated. It's very, it's boarded up. You know, it's definitely an eyesore, right? But, you know, and I guess the story was he wanted some tax incentives, which, you know, was par for the course.
Yep.
Right. And like we said, we don't blame people for wanting to pay as little taxes as possible. I think the other issue, too, was that he wanted a zoning variance that they weren't willing to grant him because he wanted to make it a residential building. Look, again, the guy wants to build a residential building. It's his property. These zoning boards shouldn't even exist, as far as I'm concerned. It's a joke. It's a means to wield corruption. That's all it is. Yep. It's all it is. So the funniest thing was that. So, of course, you know, the mayor didn't want to play ball with this guy because he's, you know, I come from the street. You know, I'm not going to tolerate this nonsense, which, by the way, is a direct quote from the article. OK, this is not me. That's actually what he said. OK, to the news, that I come from the street. You know, I'm not going to tolerate this nonsense. Are you kidding me? Is he serious? I come from the street. I'm not gonna, like, get out of here. So this guy, this Dr. Farina, in response to this, you know, the town basically giving him a hard time and basically telling him what he could do and couldn't do with his property, painted or had someone paint a giant mural of the mayor, like a caricature, you know, okay. Had to be 10 feet high of him sitting on a toilet with his pants down around his ankle and a crown on his head. Okay. Awesome. King Lombardi, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know this guy,
yeah,
but he sounds like he'd make a great libertarian. Okay. I mean, and look, yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor, but who are you to tell this guy what to do with his property? I'm sorry if it's an eyesore, but, you know, if someone can go and make the guy an offer and try and buy it and do something with it. Look, I don't suppose to be able to think that I can tell someone what to do with their property. Someone, you know, someone responded to this on Facebook and said, would you want... zoning boards are important, you know, because would you want someone opening up a strip club or a liquor store next to your house? And I'm like, first of all, that probably wouldn't happen because what kind of idiot would open up a strip club in a residential neighborhood? you're going to be out of business pretty quick, yes. Probably, number one. Modeling. Number two, if they did, then I'd probably try to move.
Yeah, you move. Or what about the opportunity that you had to purchase that property so that didn't go up there, right? Like, so there's opportunity. If you don't want that there, you can buy the property.
Yeah, I mean, look, if someone puts their money down.
And if you don't have the money to do it, well, that's your problem.
Right, and right. What is money? Money is that you earn is your labor.
Yeah.
Right? The money you spend to buy a piece of property, that's years and years and years and years of hard work. That's what that represents. It's not my hard work. Mm-hmm. It's your hard work. It's Dr. Farina's hard work. That he spent. He's still paying taxes on the property, right? And let's say that the property is blighted and there's rats and things and it's causing a nuisance. Then look, you know, maybe the town has a right to charge him some sort of a fine or a fee for cleaning up some of this stuff. But to tell him he has to knock his building down, right. Give me a break.
Right. Yeah. And to that point, right, that's another thing, you know, to talk about is if the property itself is causing damage, then there's recourse for that.
Right.
But if it's just ugly... or, you know, the shrubs are overgrown or, you know, whatever it is. Until there's harm done, then there's...
The harm that was done here was to the mayor's ego because right. He didn't like driving down the road and seeing his likeness on the side of the building, sitting on a toilet, wearing a crown with his pants around his ankles. That's why he had the building knocked down. That's why.
Just getting back real quick to the Apex building, I thought something in the article I read that was interesting was one of the people that was outspoken about... you know, moving in on Apex, Duffy, the guy that is, you know, kind of the brains, I guess, behind the guild, the brewing thing, which we talked about, which is funny. We talked about this, but now here he is. He's a big progressive, from my understanding. Do some more research.
Is this the same place that was pressured to kick out the American Futures people? It's the same place.
Oh no, that was Revival.
A different place.
Different place. Right. Now they're all connected. I don't know if they're all connected, but they might be. They might.
Right.
They're, you know, same industry. Right? Okay. So I'm sure they all know each other. But he. So he's kind of. I guess he's one of the people behind the guild. And now here you have someone who we're giving, not necessarily him, but the industry itself. We're giving credit towards, you know, deregulation and all that stuff. It's a growing, booming industry. But now here you come in. Here comes a business owner. wanting to use force of government to move something out of his neighborhood because he doesn't like it. You know, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back to, you know, the government and say, you need to use your monopoly on force to get rid of this property that I don't
like. It's such a cowardly act, isn't it? I mean, it's such a cop out. Like, you know, and it's like progressives want to act like they're so nonviolent all the time and that, you know, they don't believe in, yeah, peace. And like, you've got to be kidding me. You're such a hypocrite. You have no problem using guns when they're someone else's guns. When it's the government's guns, when it's the police's guns, you'd have no problem with it if the police went there and forced the guy to, you know, be evicted from his property. Yeah. You'd have no problem with it. They don't care. You know, and so it's like, you know, it's funny that the people who are pro gun rights, the libertarians, right, are actually the ones who are consistent in thinking that using guns is a crime.
Yeah.
Unless it's in self-defense.
That's right.
The progressives who, you know, want to get rid of gun rights are totally cool with the use of guns as long as it's the government using them.
And the government never does anything wrong with their guns, right?
I've never seen that happen. Have you?
Never.
That happen.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Only on the news every 4 weeks.
Yeah. And then again, going back to Pawtucket, the idea that the Grebian, who, you know, for all, you know, practicality, seems like a nice guy. I've met him a couple times, shook his hand. Seems like a nice, you know, person. He's very personable. But the fact that he continues to with this idea that it's government's role to make the town better, you know, not just break down, you know, knock down the walls to the barriers to business and let that thrive. You know, no, I have a vision. I'm going to impose my vision upon the, you know, city of Pawtucket. And yep. I know it's best. You know,
it's not always, doesn't always come from a place of some sort of like deep seated evil.
No,
you know, and in some cases, it is, but in some cases, like with Mr. Grebian, Mayor Grebian, you know, it's just a mindset of I'm the mayor, you know, I have to do something, I have to act, I have to, you know, I'm in charge. It's my job to make sure this happens or this doesn't happen, and it's just the wrong mindset.
Yeah,
you know, look. There's a debate amongst libertarians between, you know, how small government should be or whether there should be a government at all. But I can tell you, if there is going to be a government, it should just be to mitigate conflict. And that's right. Mitigate conflict and to protect people against aggression.
An impartial arbiter that will settle disputes and, you know.
Once you start getting in there and declaring someone else is, first of all, blighted. What is blighted? I'm sure there's a legal description of it.
Yeah.
But it seems like it's probably pretty subjective.
Pretty subjective, right?
It's blighted. Well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, so, okay, it's blighted to who? One man's junk is another man's treasure.
And then, okay, so that's the first, probably the first response by somebody who's under threat of being, you know, their property being stolen through eminent domain. So now what do you do? To define blighted, you have to go to court, right? So now you're going to start spending money on lawyer fees and all this other stuff. So now how long can you do that? You know, and the government has an endless pocket, you know, bottomless pocket for lawyers and
they offer you a nice sum of money and you feel like you know, what's my recourse here? I don't want to be tied up in court.
Right.
And that's another way of using force, saying, look, we're going to tie you up in court.
That's a good point you bring up, too, because that's often the, you know, what's thrown back at especially libertarians on the eminent domain issue is, well, the government pays for the property. They pay fair market value. But who's to determine what your property is worth? Like, I know what my house might sell for on the market, but it's my house. It's where my children were raised. It's where maybe I want to grow old. You know, it's my property. I've built the, you know, whatever, the patio, and I've done all this stuff.
Yep.
That's for me to determine what the value of my property
is. It's for you now, to determine, and the person who wants to buy it.
And the market will tell me what I value it as is what the rest of the people value. But what's the recourse there, or what's the response there, is I don't sell my property if I want to, because I think it's worth this. The market says no, so I just don't sell it.
Well, it's like that guy,
it doesn't get sold.
It's like that guy from The Notebook, you know, not to get really kind of like, you know, sappy here, but right, there's that whole part of the movie where, you know, he revamps and remodels this whole house and then doesn't want to sell it.
Right.
And one guy offered like, you know, twice as much money for it. And he was like, you're out of your mind. I'm not going to do that. That's crazy. You must be a crazy person. And he runs them off the property with a shotgun. Yeah. I mean, look, this whole fair market value thing is complete nonsense, because you can't determine fair market value until after the transaction has taken place.
That's right. Whatever it sells for is the most.
That's the right. Whatever you're able to sell the house for, and you don't know what you're able to sell it for. You might have a general idea based on what other houses in the neighborhood have sold for in the past, but it really depends on the buyer. You might get a buyer who really, really wants to. If you get two buyers who really, really want that property, it's going to be worth a lot more than you thought.
Right.
Right. And if you get nobody who wants it and it's been on the market for a year, it's going to be worth a lot less than you thought. And that's, but you don't know until that happens.
And what about 5 years from now, 10 years from now, if something happens and the value of that property goes through the roof and you wanted to hold on to it because you thought that that might happen, or you didn't even know, but you're not able to take advantage of that at that time because the property was stolen from you.
So, right. Right. And value is subjective.
Right.
It's all subjective. And, you know, like you said, this is the house that you grew up in. Let's say you did a lot of work on it yourself. Your children grew up in the house. I mean, it's, you might not be able to even put a number on what it's worth. It might be invaluable.
Right.
You might not sell it for anything. We don't know. And that's not for some bureaucrat or some politician to tell you what your property is worth. Right. And they do the same thing with taxes, right? All of our property taxes are based off this, you know, these assessments that they do of what your property is worth, which is another totally corrupt process.
The government's coming in to assess my property to tell you to evaluate it, and then so they can charge me taxes on that figure. Right. So
yeah, seems like a conflict of interest to me.
Yes.
You know, my favorite one is when, you know, it's an election year and the council doesn't want to raise taxes. So what do? They here come the assessors.
Right.
Oh wow, my assessment went up by $10,000. That's interesting. I'm paying more taxes, but my tax rate didn't go up.
No.
So they can claim they didn't raise taxes. Meanwhile, they're collecting more revenue, and there's nothing you can do about it.
No.
Yeah. There's nothing you can do about it. That's it. It's basically a way of raising taxes without any sort of a vote, or, you know, or any sort of public input. So look, and so that's why I think with libertarians, property rights is probably the most important issue. Yeah. Because property encompasses like. Just everything we've talked about so far tonight. When it comes to drug use, your body is your property.
That's right.
You have a right to your property. Whether or not you want to sell drugs on your property and to people, that's your property. Almost every issue comes down to property rights.
I'm a firm believer, going on a little philosophical tangent here, is that, you know, the idea behind libertarianism is based in property rights. Everything stems from that. Again, cell phone. I had an interesting discussion a couple nights back with somebody, just talking about libertarianism, and we were talking about the idea of property rights, and then and self ownership came up, and he kind of had a click. Oh, that makes sense. You own your body,
right?
So, you know, the idea of self ownership, and then from that stems the non-aggression principle, right? So, you know, nobody has a right to harm you because it's your property. Nobody has a right to harm your property, as in your physical property, your house. Because it's your property, right? So everything stems from property rights, in my opinion.
Yeah, no,
and there are
absolutely
different views on this, but
you know, and look, these brilliant philosophers and thinkers of the last 300 years who came up with these ideas were not just they weren't rubes.
No,
I mean, these are brilliant, brilliant people who spent a lot of time thinking about this stuff, and they realized that, you know, life, liberty, and property is not some just quaint notion they came up with. It's steeped in logic, and it's also steeped in a sense of, you know, what are the things that you innately own without requiring anybody else's labor, anybody else's services, right? Like you have your life. You're alive.
Right.
Like you are alive. You were born, you are alive, right? And every second of every day you are alive. No one's giving that to you. So you have a right to that life. Right, it doesn't require anybody else giving it to you. I mean, your parents brought you into this world, but the fact that you are alive is completely out of anyone else's control, unless they kill you, in which case that would be a violation of your rights.
Right.
And in the same with property, if you own your body, you also own anything that you make with your body, and that's where property rights come from. And that's why using a government to take people's money or take people's property by eminent domain or through taxation or whatever, when you get down to it, is just downright immoral and it's wrong. And whether or not you can justify it in any sort of practical way you want to, that's fine. Then look, for you, if you think that those things are okay, then you think the ends justify the means, and you don't really care what the means are. And that's a dangerous, dangerous road to go down, because once you say the ends can justify the means, there's a that sort of thought process has led to some of the last couple of centuries' worst atrocities.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, yeah.
And look, those are the things we're fighting against.
Yeah. It's difficult to explain that when you say the idea again. We have the little funny phrase, "taxation is theft," whatever. You know, a lot of some people actually are vehemently against saying that. But the reality is, when we say that, there is a meaning to that, right? When you pay taxes, it's money that is taken from you to pay for things that you might not want to pay for. You know, services and things you don't necessarily agree with or want to pay for. It goes even deeper than that, though. Like we're talking about, the money that they take from you was earned by you through your labor, right? Through the use of your time and skill and energy to make that money. That's something you can never get back. Like, you can't go back and, turn back the clock and make that money again. The time is gone in the span of your life. That time is gone. Obviously, we're going to die at some point. So it really is a, important thing to understand that people don't. They just, again, people live day to day. They don't care. They don't think that deeply about it. But when you start to think that deeply about it, that's why it's so immoral. And the reality is, taxation is theft. They're stealing this from you.
And this is, and the moral argument to me is the one that's the most persuasive. Right. You can talk tax policy with people until you're blue in the face.
Right.
But when you get right down to it, it's just wrong. And you talked about, that's your labor. That's you're never going to get that back. I mean, when it comes down to it, we're all indentured servants. Mm-hmm. That's all we are. We're indentured servants to the government. We work, and a third of the time that we work, we're working for free,
yeah.
Basically. I mean, look, they say that we're getting services back for that money, and there's all sorts of arguments, but the point is that I didn't have a choice in that.
No.
And talk about people who are pro-choice. I mean, if you believe in personal choice, you need to be in favor of personal choice for everything, not just things that you like.
Right.
Or things that you think are okay. It has to be personal choice means personal choice. It's your body, your choice, your labor, your choice, your property, your choice.
Yeah.
And there really shouldn't be any limits on that. I'm sorry. In terms of, especially if you're looking at it morally.
No.
And just to move on to the next thing we wanted to talk about is something we haven't touched on yet, but it's something that is a very pervasive aspect of life in the state, which is the Commerce Corporation. And I know that you had looked into this a little bit, and you found a news story that was interesting, and you got some information. So I honestly, I don't know a lot about the Commerce Corporation and their activities, so I'm fascinated to hear what you found and what you have to say about it.
Yeah, I don't know that much about it either. It's one of those. It's literally called a quasi-government agency, right? So I did a little just digging into something I want to learn more about and figure out more as time goes on. But they have they provide. Economic incentive to bring businesses into the state or to promote business within the state. So they have, grants and things that they give out and whatnot. So they are largely taxpayer funded. Let me pull up the links here real quick. But what started this journey down the rabbit hole was they just provided an additional round of what they call innovation vouchers, and it was three companies that they provided: Pawtucket-based Cooley Group, Warwick-based Kinney Manufacturing, and Providence-based The Compost Plant. And they received $50,000, $50,000, and $49,000, $92, which is a funny figure. But
that's weird. I saw that. what did they do wrong on their application?
Yeah. It looks like The Compost Plant received a little bit less money for their compost, I guess. It says, upon approval, that will mark 62 companies receiving such grants, totaling nearly $3 million in total funds. So this is money that they're supposed to use for innovation and research and development and things like that. But again, it's handed out selectively, right? So what does that typically breed?
Corruption.
Corruption.
This is something where when you first brought this up, sort of a pre-show, and I was looking at it on the notes and everything. My first thought was, man, I want to dive in there. I want to look at every single one of these companies. Who's on the boards of these companies? Yeah. What connections do they have to people in the state? Because look, unfortunately, this is where the moral hazard comes in. And it's like, there's too much incentive for people, for these bureaucrats and these politicians to use a system like this to their own ends. And they're as opposed to the ends of the marketplace and the ends of the consumer. Look, if these companies were worthy of this money to put into innovation, then the customer
or investors will fund it.
We don't, look, this is 38 studios all over again. It's not a big figure like 38 studios, but the same principle still applies.
They're nickel and diming it.
If they can't get private investment, that means it's not a good investment.
That's right.
And just because you're some bureaucrat who thinks this, composting is a great thing. Yeah, I personally think composting is a great idea. But unfortunately, you can't force something like that to happen if people don't want it. And all you're going to end up doing is putting resources where they don't belong and creating malinvestment and just flushing money down the toilet. I mean, maybe one out of 20 of these things might actually end up working out in some way.
Yeah.
But is it worth it? I mean, no, it's not.
No. So I did a little digging just to figure out what their budget, where the Commerce Corporation budget is. And of course, it's in the quasi-government agency section of the state.
What does that mean, quasi-government?
So
it's so big.
I'll scroll back up after I read this to see if I can find the definition here. But it's essentially, it's a government government...
Created,
run by private, people aren't elected that run it.
They're sort of like the Federal Reserve.
Very much like the Federal Reserve.
Okay.
Yeah. So when you look at their budget, where they get their money in for fiscal year 2018, I'll go with that because their total budget is $15,300,000. I'll round it off. The way that breaks down is, almost half of it, just under half of it, is from direct from state appropriations. $7,224,000 comes from essentially taxes, right? The general fund, I'm guessing, or something to that effect. And then you have the other sources of revenue. Hotel tax revenue, $5,100,000. So that's
taxes too.
That's taxes as well, right? So
Why is that not lumped in under taxes?
So the... A percentage of hotel taxes that people pay when they come to the state goes directly to the Commerce Corporation, which is...
So they can build more hotels, which they've been building.
Yeah.
So they can collect more taxes.
And the funny thing is, that's $5,100,000 taking out of the economy for people staying at hotels that could have gone to a restaurant, they could have gone to, buying souvenirs, who knows what. But anyway, that's money that's no longer available in the economy because,
actually what you just said is a really interesting point, especially in the specifics of talking about hotels, right? Why would hotels be built in a place? Because people want to go there. Why do people want to go there? Because there's stuff to do there, not just because they want to be in Providence just to be there, right? It's because there's great restaurants. It's because there's great attractions, right? And so one follows the other. Right. Hotels will spring up in a place when there's demand for the tourism, and the demand from the tourism comes from attractions and from restaurants. And so you're putting the cart before the horse. The money that you're saying could have gone towards restaurants and other things is being put towards hotels that might not even end up being filled.
Again, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier about they think they know what's best to how to use this money best. So
they want
to
play God,
steal the money,
and sculpt the landscape the way that they envision it.
Instead of letting consumers do what they wish with the money, they think, oh, we need to take this $5 million because we know how to spend it better than they know how to spend it. So,
or not spend it. In the case of, this just came out a couple days ago with this Fain Tower development in Providence. Here's a company. Okay. This is mind blowing. Here's a company that wants to build $300 million building and develop this property that people wanted to develop for how many years now with no public money attached to it. This guy wants to put all of his own resources into it. The council passes it and the mayor vetoes it and says, no, sorry, go home. I don't like your idea. Are you kidding me? So we got, okay, so let me get this straight. We have mayors who want to build stadiums using taxpayer money, who want to knock down buildings they don't like
and
redevelop properties they don't like, and also want to tell people not to develop properties because they don't like what they're going to do. Is that, is this when there's no taxpayer money involved? Is that what's happening here?
Yeah. Bizarro. Bizarro world.
It's bizarro world. It is. It's bizarro Superman. You know, he says goodbye when he arrives and hello when he leaves.
So going further down, we have finance program reimbursements, which I don't know what that is. $246,000. Then we have federal grant reimbursements. So federal money from federal government is almost 1.9 million. And then the last one is other. So I don't know what that is.
Very descriptive.
$841,000.
Actually, I think at one point I had done some research for somebody on the Commerce Corporation, maybe 6 months ago, at their financials. And, I don't have the specifics off the top of my head, but I do remember there being a pretty sizable amount of money that just went towards travel for the people on the corporation.
Yeah.
Travel, food costs. I mean, all this stuff is paid for on the taxpayer dime. Everything they eat, every ounce of gas they use, every airline ticket that they buy, conferences that they go to learn about how to be better commerce corporateers or whatever the hell. And so maybe that falls under other, you know, they don't want to say flat out, like, you know, a conference at Mar-a-Lago, you know, that just came off on top of my head. Mar-a-Lago.
Right.
But I'm just saying, you know, they're going to Tulsa or they're going to Minneapolis for some convention, and that's, you know, oh, other, you know, yeah, yeah. Other.
So I'm just looking at this right now real quick, and it does have the expense breakdown, but it's not adding up to me. It's not making sense, but just total operation, personnel and operating expenses is $13.4 million of the $15.3 million budget.
Are you serious?
And then it says grant partnership expenses, $1.8 million, almost $1.9 million.
So again, let me get this straight. Out of the $15 million we give them,
right,
it's not even like they're just taking this money and divvying it all out. $13 million of it, of the $15 million, is going towards just the operating expenses.
That's what it's looking like. But then when you break it, when you go down further and it goes into the different programs and how that's broken up, it doesn't, that totals 6.5 million. So I don't know what's going, unless those, so for example, I'll just take innovative matching grants is $1 million. Now is that $1 million that goes out, or is that $1 million include those not only the grant money but the operating costs?
It has to.
Well, so it must.
They've got people that have to, you know, I mean, what does it actually take to dole money out?
Right.
I mean, I can't imagine that it would, how could it possibly cost that much money just to dole out money? It's costing us 13 times more money to dole out money.
Right. The biggest line item on here is the renewable energy fund at almost $2.9 million dollars. And then the next one down is the airport impact aid, $1 million.
I mean,
a little over a million.
And look, all this is just corporate welfare. And, you know, when you look at it, 50,000 here, 50,000 there doesn't sound like a lot. But when you talk about it, $15 million, it's corporate welfare.
Right.
Where are the progressives on this? Where are the progressives standing up and screaming about the Commerce Corporation and all this corporate welfare?
They're not going to do it when $2.8 million is going to the Renewable Energy Fund.
That's their issue.
It's okay if we steal money for that and help finance those businesses. But, you know, Bob, who wants to start, not that I would agree with it, but Bob, who wants to start a, you know, plumbing business or whatever, I don't know.
Right.
But, you know, a coal fired power plant, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's, you know, and look, I think that's one of the reasons I think that the two of us feel so strongly about this podcast and why we're so excited about it is calling BS on so much of this crap, on all this doublespeak, all this hypocrisy that comes especially from the left. Look, there's plenty of it on the right too.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that, and we have gotten into it. But when it's, you know, for me, there's, when it comes to being a libertarian, there are two major issues. One of them is foreign policy, which we don't talk a lot. We're not going to talk a lot
about
on this show because we're focused on local issues. The other is corporate welfare. And, you know, and that's supposedly the left's baby. Bernie Sanders, you know, right. No more Wall Street. No more bailouts to Wall Street. Hey, right on, brother. I agree with you.
Yeah.
But how about no bailouts to anybody? I mean, you can't tell me. I mean, I think that the more we get this message out and we expose the hypocrisy behind all of this, you know, I'm hoping that people who are on the left who really do care about corporate welfare as an issue will look at this and say, you know what? Aaron Regenberg is a fraud.
Yeah.
He's a fraud.
He all takes of them.
All kinds of money from Deepwater Wind and all these different companies, IGT, all these big corporations who he goes and votes in favor of, bills in the state house and these Deepwater Wind got a huge contract from the state to build the wind farm. And he was a big proponent of that. So, you know, wake up.
Yeah.
Wake up, guys.
No, and my hope with the podcast before we go on to the next issue, which is a good one, is that we, through our just discussions, explain it in a clear enough way that people who haven't seen it from that angle will start to think about things a little bit differently.
Right.
And start, you know, just kind of going over in their inner minds. You know, I think we mentioned, I don't know if we've mentioned this before, but when I started down my path towards becoming a libertarian, it started off with one issue. I'm like, why does that, you know, why do we do it that way? Why do I care if, you know, someone wants to smoke weed? You know, I don't care. What doesn't harm me. But then I started applying that same logic to the next issue.
Right.
You know, when the next, yeah, you know, I had my, you know, goal, you know, sacred cows that, you know, I didn't want to give up, you know, but then I'm like, no, really, like, think about it a little deeper and go a couple steps beyond the initial, you know, surface layer thing. And then all of a sudden it's like dominoes. They just, everything just starts falling and everything. It's like that moment on the Matrix when Neo, you know, kind of everything becomes a moment of clarity. Right?
And he
everything
dives just inside of him and then explodes him from the inside out.
He starts to see everything for what it is.
Yeah. Is that what we're doing here?
Yeah, exactly. So
we want to dive into your soul and explode you from the inside out so you are reborn in a libertarian mold.
That's right. And hope, my big hope is that people who do listen to the podcast that aren't already libertarians will start to you know, start to see that. And then the people who are libertarians might get different ways to argue points with other people and, you know.
And with us. I mean, engage with us. I mean, I think that's one of the things that we've really enjoyed these first few weeks is the engagement on Facebook, through messaging and email. And we've gotten some great comments from people. People have reached out about the podcast and who have heard things that we've talked about and given us suggestions and asked questions about what we meant. And that's the whole point of this.
Yes.
I mean, that is an educational endeavor. And speaking of education.
Nice segue.
Thank you. I'm getting better at this.
So the big news this week.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Oh, man. I've been chomping at the bit from the second this came out. So, okay. So
three podcasts. We're on a third podcast. Three times we're hitting up education.
Education. So the test scores. We're on to the test scores.
Unbelievable.
All right. So let me just make sure I get this acronym right because, you know, government is an alphabet soup.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's the
RICAS.
RICAS. There it is.
Yep.
The RICAS, I guess that's what I'll call it, test. That. So the scores just came out. And obviously, you know, they're horrible. But I think what's interesting is, and this has obviously already been talked about quite a bit on talk radio and in the news and I think what I'd like to really talk about with regards to this issue is what I find fascinating is what the discussion has centered around with these test scores, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the one of the issues, of course, is the whole idea that these scores were released after the election, which is totally suspect in my. I mean, they you know, Ken Wagner, the education commissioner, had excuses for that, which I'm sorry. I don't buy it for a second. You know, people can read test scores. You don't need to spend 3 more months figuring out how to explain it to them. This obviously would have looked bad for the governor. I'm not sure it would have cost her the election, but they weren't going to take any chances.
Right.
Number one. Number two, this whole idea that, you know, so this test is the same test that Massachusetts uses, right, to, and they've been using the same test for about 15 years, I think.
Yep. 20 to 15. Yeah.
So they've been, I mean, you know, and they teach to the test in Massachusetts. This is a policy they have. So they've been teaching to the test in Massachusetts for 15 years. And Massachusetts public education system is considered the gold standard in the nation.
That's,
and internationally, someone told me in the article I saw on Facebook, someone mentioned internationally recognized.
Yeah.
And 50% of the students failed the test. So let me get this straight. Okay. Now, just so people are wondering, because originally when I heard about this, I figured, okay, well, maybe a passing grade on the test is what? Maybe it's like a 70,
mm-hmm,
right? No. It's a 50.
It's a 50.
The test is scored between 440 on the low end and 560 on the high end. 500 is passing. That's smack dab right in the middle. Okay. I cannot remember at any point in my schooling, in my entire life, where half the kids in the class got a 50% on a test or worse. That, if that happened, I'm sorry, that teacher would have been fired,
yeah,
the very next year. And like I said in the previous podcast, I went to private school. That teacher would have been gone. That teacher might have been gone the next week. I don't even know. But the idea that in Rhode Island, now, of course, we're at 30% proficiency, which means 70% of the kids failed the test. And when I say failed the test, they got a 50% or lower on the test. Now, these are elementary school-aged and middle school-aged children, okay? So, you know, and you've heard people on talk radio, and they've been blaming, you know, the teachers and blaming the kids. Some of them are blaming the kids, and which is, I mean, these aren't juniors in high school, folks. These are fifth graders and sixth graders, okay? They're blaming the parents. They're blaming all sorts of the administration. They're blaming the state bureaucrats, right? There's plenty of blame to go around.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. The parents are to blame. The teachers are to blame. The administrators are to blame. They're all to blame. But you know what the problem with public education is, folks? Public education. That's the problem. The problem is public education. When you have the gold standard of your industry, just to use for lack of a better term,
right,
is a 50% proficiency. When, look, if you take private education, there's no way. I went to private school my whole life. The proficiency, it was easily 75% or higher, easily, at a minimum.
Right.
Okay.
Passing grade.
Passing grade was 60.
60, right. 60, yeah.
It wasn't even 50. It was, right, 60. If you got a 60.
Like a D, right, essentially.
A 60 or, yeah, lower was an F.
Yeah.
And a 59 is an F.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, and so what does that tell you? People who are out there saying we got to figure out how to do this to teach to the test so we can be as good as Massachusetts. Is that our goal? To be a little less crappy? I mean, I like sports. I'm a sports fan, right? I'm not a rabid fan, but I know, you know, I like to use sports as a metric sometimes. I know my friend Mike Stenhouse, a little shout out to him, loves using the baseball analogies. Okay.
Yeah.
It's like saying a guy batting 150. You know, a guy is batting 150 and, oh man, what are we going to do with this guy? We got to figure out how can we get him hitting 200? What do we have to do to get him to hit 200?
Right.
If that's your goal, folks, you should just cut the guy, send him down to AAA and, you know, or single A, or I don't know, high school baseball,
Little League
and be done with it. This to me is the greatest evidence that we've seen that public education doesn't work.
Right.
And look, again, there's plenty of blame to go around, but these are all symptoms. The teachers, the unions, the administrators, the parents, it's all a symptom of the issue. Look, if you're a parent, and there are parents who their kids don't pay attention, they don't listen, they don't do well in school, and they defend their kids,
mm-hmm,
right? These parents exist. We know it, yep, right? So what do you think would happen, Mike, if the principal sat down a parent and said, look, if your kid doesn't start behaving, if he doesn't start, you know, trying, doing his homework, turning it in on time, sorry, he's gone.
Yeah.
He's out of school and you're going to have to watch him all day. How fast do you think that parent would sit that kid down and say, you better get your act together? Because I can't sit home and watch you all day, and I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
In 2 seconds, but that doesn't happen.
No.
Right?
No,
it's no child left behind, which, by the way, we rag on the progressives. That was the Republican idea. Thanks, Republicans.
Yeah.
Thanks, yeah. George Bush, the son. You know, George Bush, the son. We're not going to, look, we have our issues with George Bush, the father. He just died. Yeah, I like to give it a day.
Yeah.
Before we start criticizing someone who just died. Okay. But his son passed this no child left behind thing. And look, you've got 70% of the kids can't get a 50 or higher on a test, but they're all moving on to the next grade, aren't they?
Right. Right. Right.
They're all moving on. So what does that tell you?
I hear you.
It does. It gets me so mad, Mike. It gets me so mad.
I think one of the biggest gripes I've had in this discussion that goes back and forth is people hitting at the symptoms, right? Again, symptoms, not the disease. Oh, it's Common Core. Oh, it's this. Oh, it's that. You know, I put that aside. For one, Common Core is a government standard.
Right.
Government standard, you know? Yeah, so again, what's the problem here? What's the continuing theme on all these issues? Granted, there are some issues that parents aren't as involved in their education. Again, I think that's by design. You know, the system's evolved to make parents not want to get involved in their children's education.
Right.
And therefore, they don't push back. You know, I'm not saying every parent, obviously. But
no.
But it's common. Again, I mentioned my wife's a teacher, and there are obvious. And she works at a school where the kids that are there want to be there, right? It's a charter school. So, you know, it's the parents want their kids to be there because they have to go through that process. But, and so she doesn't see it as much, but she's worked at other schools. I mean, she's been a teacher for a long time. So it's obvious what parents are involved and what parents aren't. And you know, it really goes back to a cultural issue at this point, right?
Yes, absolutely. That's a big part of the problem. But again, part of the problem, shout out to Dave Smith, part of the problem. And, you know, if we look at, you know, how did, you know, and honestly, I don't even like to call it public education at this point. I like to call it state education. Mm-hmm. It's state
education. It's government. Yeah, I've been
government education because, you know, when schools first came about, it was people in a community who got together and said, you know, look, we need to consolidate some resources here. A lot of times it was the teacher was a woman in the neighborhood who didn't have her own kids, right? Who would teach the kids all day, and maybe there'd be, you know, 20 kids in the neighborhood. It was very localized.
Yep.
And it was something that was created voluntarily by the people in that community for their own ends and their own purposes. And what you have now is eventually they got to a point where the state from the top started taking more and more control and removing it from the local community. Now, I'm not saying public education would be perfect if it was super localized. It would be better. It would not be perfect. And I still am against it. But at least in that instance, it was a voluntary association amongst parents in a community who had were doing it of their own volition and cared.
Yeah.
And that's the cultural aspect you're talking about. Now, the schools aren't run by the parents. They're not run by the teachers. They're not run by even the local school boards.
No.
The school boards have no say in curriculum. They have no say. They have no say in hardly anything, even budget matters. It's all state and federal mandates.
You're right. And you know, it's interesting you say that too, because I've even heard libertarians say this. Our good, you know, late friend Bob Healy was for state level control of schools. And I don't agree with that. You know,
right.
The state, he'll like the state level contract and all that other stuff. And I mean, he had nuances to it, but I'm just the opposite. Each school should be its own school district, like a charter school.
Yes.
Like the schools are their districts.
Yes. You know, I just had this conversation
Regionalize. People talk about we need to regionalize.
No.
We need to go the opposite direction.
Absolutely.
You know,
one of the biggest fallacies you hear about is regionalization and regionalization, whether it's education or police or fire. It's a huge fallacy.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I was, again, just full disclosure, almost everyone in my family is a teacher. My mother's a teacher. My wife's a teacher. My in-laws are teachers. Okay. And I was talking to my mom about this just a couple of days ago. You know, even like your local school boards, like let's say in a town, it should be more localized than that. Every school should have its own school board that focuses just on that one school. And that's it. And the parents who live in that district, who send their kids to that school, can report to those representatives directly just for that one school. It should be that education is such a local issue. Mm-hmm. It's so local that before schools were even created, where did education happen? It happened in the home.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a personal local thing. And we're so ass backwards on this.
And before anybody, you know, pushes back on this, I'm not saying, you know, I'm for the complete abolishing of government schools. So, but I'm saying within the context of what it is now,
right,
you know, let's, you know, if we're going to push it anyway, push it back down instead of broadening it.
I think, and I think you would find if you pushed it back down to the more local level, you'd have a smaller public education system. And to the point where more private schools would actually be able to come in. And I think you'd eventually, the public schools would either be forced to compete,
right,
or they'd have to fade away.
Yeah. Now, and a couple of other points that I've thought of, you know, one being now, again, going back to that, the point of, you know, more localized and smaller districts, if you will, down to the school level. That's not to say that schools can't work together to say bulk purchase toilet paper, you know. Yeah, that's not what we're saying. You know, we're talking about the actual running and administration of
they can figure that out themselves,
and that's what happens in the free market. People form co-ops and, you know, all that type of stuff.
There's probably some sort of state law that says that schools can't pool their
resources to buy toilet paper.
For all we know.
I don't know. So that's certainly something there. And interestingly enough, I'm reading a book. I just started reading. I'm probably about 5 chapters in now, called The Beautiful Tree. It's because the pushback is when we say we need to abolish public or government education, the pushback is, well, the poor won't be able to afford to go to school. And this book is entirely about poor, you know, private education for poor people. And when I say poor, I'm talking India, Africa, like people that make, I think one of the figures, $134 a year, and they opt to send their children to the private school because the public school is so bad.
Right.
You know, so, but there is a market for the for private schools, and they're allowed to, you know, to thrive. And it's fascinating.
Isn't it sort of like a no frills school model, in the sense of, like, there's, you know, there's no sports teams, there's no cafeteria, there's no, you know, it just focuses just on education. You know, they don't need a big fancy building. Nope. They need something that's warm in the winter and, you know, maybe cool in the summer. That's
keeps,
you know,
out of the rain,
keeps the rain, right, keeps the rain out. And, you know, obviously we're not talking about having tent
schools here in yeah,
but there's a lot of, there is, you know, there's, but in even like libraries, do we need libraries anymore with technology today? It's just, so, like, this is the point, is that the people always say, like you said, that, you know, that people wouldn't be able to afford schooling. That is totally untrue.
So
how many people do you know that can't afford to go to McDonald's?
Right. No.
And exactly. That's what it would be like if it was totally free and open.
Yeah. And listening, it's on my Kindle and audiobook, so I drive and read when I get home, that some of these children, the poorest of the poor, do go for free. So,
right,
you know, they're the owners of these private schools are also giving back to the community. They understand that people who are in need, and they cover their costs, you know, and we're talking, like, you know, very minimal. Now, okay, so the argument I can already see is going to be, well, we can't do that in our modern society because whatever reason. Well, the author of this book is putting his literal money where his mouth is and is opening up a low-cost school in, I believe it's called Dunbar, England. He's an English guy, the author of this book. And guess who's pushing back on him opening up this low cost private school?
Oh, hold on, let me think. Does it rhyme with Goonians?
Exactly. So the teacher unions do not like this idea. You know, he can't possibly offer a good education for this low price. And what he's done, he's found a cheap, inexpensive, I'll say, you know, location that he can use to, for the classroom and all this stuff. I've only listened, it's not in the book, I've only listened to his story on a podcast. So I'm going to listen more, and I'm interested in finding out more about what he's doing.
It's called The Beautiful Tree.
The Beautiful Tree is the book. Yeah.
Awesome.
I'll throw up a link in there.
Yeah, that's a great, you know, I think that one of the hardest challenges we have is explaining what a free market education model would look like, because we've never really seen it.
Yeah.
And you know, it is hard for people to wrap their minds around something they've never seen. And so, you know, we try to do the best job we can, obviously, but I also have heard about this book, and something I definitely want to read is The Beautiful Tree. And also the book that I have read was School Revolution by Ron Paul.
Okay.
Which is also another,
I've not read that.
It has a lot to do with homeschooling, but also just talks about how you don't need this big public education apparatus. It's not necessary. And look, get out there and read these things. Yeah. There's a lot of great resources out there and that can explain how these things can work probably better than we can.
Yeah. Just the last point I wanted to, yeah. So interesting. I got into a discussion on Facebook with Spencer Dickinson, who ran for governor in the Democratic primary. And he was trying to understand the libertarian position on this. And of course, what's the response when you say abolish things like, you know, taxes? We talk about taxes and taxation is theft. And well, who's going to pay for the schools and the police? And that's it. So my response was, okay, so do you think the more, you know, again, it's a position of moral position, right? So we need to educate the children. They need education. Well, do you think the moral high ground is educating them through theft or through another voluntary means? And I made the point, like I think you were getting it earlier, is have we as a society, we can't figure out how to do this at this point with all the technology at our disposal without putting a gun to people's head to take their money to do it? Like,
it's a lot easier to put a gun to someone's head,
right? And then you got people on, and we heard it on the radio this week, that they just can't conceive of another way. So when you throw this at them, they're in this mindset that this is the way it's done and this is how we have to do it. No, we need a paradigm shift in thinking.
Yep.
And just because you don't have the intellectual capacity to understand that there might be another way, that you're going to, you know, be stuck in this system. It's absurd. There is another way that this can be done.
Yep.
Yes, it's drastically different, but why can't we put our, you know, thoughts together and figure out how to do it?
We totally can. And like, just one last thing I'll say is that, like you said on a previous podcast, if people want to educate their children, they'll educate their children and they'll find a way to do it. And they'll come up with the money, and whether it's through charity or other means, we will educate. If we want to do something, we'll do it.
We missed an episode, so we went a little bit longer. Which is fine.
But if you want to, again, like I mentioned, please get in touch with us. We love the audience engagement. We love people asking questions. You can find us on libertyri.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, also LibertyRI. We are always on sort of checking these things. So don't feel shy about contacting us on those platforms. You can also listen to the podcast. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, most major podcast networks, Google Play, I think is another one. So you can find us there. You can also email us directly, eric@libertyri.com and mike@libertyri.com. Get in touch with us. We're having a blast at the podcast so far, and we love engaging with all of you. And we will see you next time with, I'm sure, dozens more issues to talk about.
Yep, take it easy.
You've been listening to the Rhode Island Liberty Report. Be sure to check us out at libertyri.com.